it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, super senses. Have you ever wished you had an extra sixth sense, like x-ray vision or supersonic hearing? Well, welcome to the brave new world of sensory experimentation. Artists, scientists, and engineers pushing the limits of our senses. This hour, we'll meet a psychiatrist who's finding new ways to help people recover from trauma and an artist who's turned himself into a sensory cyborg. First, imagine you could mix and match your senses so you could see music or hear colors. It's a neurological condition called synesthesia, and neuroscientist David Eagleman says it's been prized by artists for a long time.
Kandinsky, when he would hear music, would see shapes and colors and textures. So he would blast his phonograph and stand in front of his canvas and essentially paint what he was seeing. So if you can imagine a Kandinsky, that was, for him, music. It only made sense to him exactly what that music sounded like and how it looked, but nonetheless, for the rest of us, it makes a beautiful painting. It makes a very unusual sort of sights and shapes and textures all put together. There are something like 150 different recorded forms of synesthesia. It can be a mixture of the senses in any way that you can imagine. Some people will hear a name and it will put a taste in their mouth. Other people, they'll taste something and it will make them feel like there's something being felt on their fingertips. Different areas of the brain are talking with one another in ways that they don't in a normal brain.
Alphabet.
Probably the most common form of synesthesia, things like numbers and letters will trigger color experiences. Vladimir Nabokov had synesthesia. He had grown up reading Cyrillic, and then when he moved to the United States, he was reading our alphabet, and his colors transferred, and so he had synesthesia in both alphabets, and he really appreciated it. Vladimir Nabokov's wife was also synesthetic, and their son, Dmitry, is also synesthetic. It turns out synesthesia is heritable. One subject that I've studied in detail is a musician, and she has extraordinarily rich synesthesia. For every pitch, for every chord, for every instrument timbre, she experiences shapes, colors, and textures. She also feels as though her body is leaping or sliding or falling when there are different key changes, for example. We have several idioms in our language that almost certainly were given to us by synesthetes. So when you talk about somebody having a loud shirt, a sweet personality, or smooth jazz, or sharp cheese, things like this. Those were almost certainly expressions that were introduced by synesthetes, and yet they stick in the language because they sort of make sense. We sort of get it. It just seems sort of natural to us that a high note would kind of be small and bright, and a low note would be big and darker. It does appear that there are certain connections across the senses that everybody seems to share, although at an unconscious level for most of us.
That's neuroscientist David Eagleman. Wonder if you might have synesthesia? You'll find a link to his test on our website, ttbook.org. And just a few decades ago, a lot of neuroscientists thought synesthesia was a myth. So is it possible that there are other sensory phenomena that have yet to be recognized? Sarah Nix brings us a kind of astonishing story about an experience a lot of people are just discovering they share. Who knows, maybe you do too.
Remember this old PBS show?
Hello, I'm Bob Ross, and I'd like to welcome you. First of all, let me take just a moment to thank you for allowing me back into your homes.
It's The Joy of Painting with Bob Ross. It's a simple program, just Ross in a room with a canvas. Palette in hand, he talks you through how to paint one scene or another, a mountain range, a waterfall, some northern lights.
Put a little of the liquid white, go right into some yellow, a little sap.
You can hear his careful instructions and the brush on the canvas.
Tap it. Okay, let's go right up here.
It's a funny kind of show. Very 1980s PBS. There hasn't been a new episode in about 10 years, but it's still broadcast around the country, maybe because it's got a particular cult following, and not just people who want to paint.
I would watch that show through. I was not a painter, not an artist, but just that deliberate, almost kind of zen quality that he has. I remember sitting and watching that show quietly and feeling this wonderful, beautiful feeling. And it's a tingling feeling, and it goes down through my shoulders and sometimes down my back. And it's as if somebody is stroking you or petting you, if you were a cat, maybe, softly and gently, and you just rise up to enjoy that feeling. It puts you in kind of a different sort of mindset.
That's Stephanie Elkins. She's a music host here at our mother station, Wisconsin Public Radio. What she's describing is a set of sensations, tingling, quiet euphoria, called ASMR. That stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. It sounds like a medical term, but it isn't. It's a catch-all name for an experience that thousands, maybe millions of people have.
Good evening. This is Marie again with you.
If you Google it, you'll find terms like brain orgasm or concentration euphoria.
To your relaxation.
Turns out a network of online communities have sprung up around ASMR. There are dozens of channels on YouTube where people are posting videos to trigger the tingles and that relaxed feeling. There are videos of people folding towels, doing puzzles, getting haircuts. They're all done incredibly slowly and quietly. If people talk, they whisper, sometimes very, very quietly.
I'm going to use my 3D microphone, my Wonder Brush.
That was all news to Stephanie. She just thought it was something that happened to her. So we sat down to watch some videos together.
Sure.
I guess we'll start with the loudest part of the video, and that is...
When people talk in the videos, they're almost inaudible.
Tapping.
So you can really hear the sibilance and clicks of the consonants.
Spectacle.
In one, a woman is whispering into a fancy stereo microphone, moving from side to side.
Spectacle.
The sounds of tapping or brushing or paper shuffling, they're usually at about the same volume as the voices.
I got some of the tingling and response.
Stephanie feels a little tingle here and there.
Okay, so it's full.
And then we get to a video of a man folding a paper airplane.
This is just wild.
Cool.
I'm having the strongest response to this one. And it triggered some memories of events where I must have heard a man whispering or nothing specific, but it was, yeah, it just went shot right through my neck and back and shoulders.
So I have to say here, for all the videos I've watched, I haven't had a single tingle. I'm wondering if I should be jealous because I've run across about six people who do get the tingles and that quiet euphoria zen thing that comes with them. What is this thing? Time to talk to an expert.
I am Ilse Blunsert, and I make videos for relaxation purposes on YouTube.
What a whisper, Ilse.
My whole channel is especially dedicated to people who experience ASMR.
Ilse says she's experienced the tingles for as long as she can remember, but she discovered the name ASMR by accident when she was in university.
I was in my final year and I was really stressed out. I had trouble sleeping. So I decided to look on YouTube for relaxing voices because I was aware of the fact that relaxing voices could possibly give me tingles, which can help me to fall asleep. So I just gave it a shot.
Thanks to those videos, her insomnia and anxiety pretty much went away. Ilse says ASMR changed her life a lot, for the better. And she wanted to give something back to the community. So a couple of months later, she shot her first video.
And oh my God.
In it, she tells the story of discovering ASMR while she slowly trails her hand through a bowl of dried pasta.
Macaroni. Because I think it's a pretty relaxing noise.
It became my full-time job in September 2012. Back then, my channel grew so fast, and I got so many people following me that they just motivated me. It started off as a hobby, and it grew into, like, one of my biggest passions.
Ilse's made more than 300 ASMR trigger videos since then. More than 130,000 people subscribe to her channel. All in all, the videos have been viewed more than 20 million times. So what kind of videos get the most attention?
You can basically split up ASMR in four categories. Visual stimuli, you have sounds, you have voices, and then you have touch, which is like more of like role plays kind of videos. Someone is talking to you like you're having an appointment at a hair salon. The fact that someone is sitting in front of you and is being nice to you, that can give a very, very pleasant, tingly sensation. And that's, from what I've noticed, a lot of people like that.
Watching a video of a stranger pretending to cut your hair? It sounds a little weird, right? The truth is, for those of us who don't experience ASMR, the videos can seem a little odd. They feel really, really intimate. And so there's a strange tension of like, well, why am I having intimacy with this person through this YouTube channel? And it seems like for many of the people who have ASMR, the intimacy is central.
Yeah, I think it's about the fact that you try to make people comfortable, that they can trust you and that they kind of can surrender. It's very similar to hypnosis, for example. Hypnosis is also a voluntary state of mind.
Is it like hypnosis? That's Ilse's number one theory. But despite the thousands of testimonials online, neuroscience isn't studying the phenomenon. There's one blog post from a neuroscientist who wrote, "Maybe it's like that little shiver we get during a musical crescendo." Another neuroscientist told me that there are no academic articles on ASMR. 20 years ago, researchers weren't interested in synesthesia either. They thought it was a myth. Maybe ASMR's in the same boat?
Hi there.
Then I came across Trevor Cox. He's a professor of acoustics and audio engineering, and he studied reactions to a whole different kind of sound, the disgusting ones.
People eating with their mouths open and people coughing and things like that.
He asked people to rate the disgust they felt. And then, of course, there were the nails on the chalkboard.
Yeah, we had a variety of scraping sounds in there as well, but the actual recording I made of fingernails down the blackboard didn't score that high. People seem to have different reactions to this. So there's lots of people, us just talking about fingernails down the blackboard make them want to turn the radio off and leave the room, I'm afraid. But there's people like me who I could listen to it all day long. It doesn't really make much difference to me.
Yeah, you know, even when I imagine the sound, my skin crawls just a little bit.
Oh, people have really extreme responses to it.
And what about pleasant sounds and ASMR?
It's interesting. I met someone who was telling me all about this a few weeks ago. And the explanation that this person gave to me was, if you have something, you know, someone whispering slightly inaudible, that implies someone's really close to you. And there's a sort of intimacy there. And maybe that's what's triggering the kind of very strong response. You know, lots of those human sort of kind of our everyday lives or even strange things that have never been researched because there's no real drivers. It just needs a scientist to get intrigued to study this phenomenon and then maybe we'll have an answer.
Stephanie Elkin says she doesn't really care if there's science behind it or not. She's learning something new about herself.
Oh my gosh.
There's a world waiting for you on the internet.
Bizarre.
So if I walk by your office and you're streaming paper plane instructions, I'll know that you are doing well.
I'm getting a little lift. Instead of a cup of tea, I'll have a video.
Relax, let it flow. Think like water. Think like water. Relax, let it flow. You can go on and on and on.
Sarah Nix brought us that story. If you want to know more about ASMR, you can hear her full-length and kind of fascinating conversations with Stephanie and Ilse on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll meet an artist who figured out a way to give himself an entirely new sense. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. We're talking about super senses in this hour. There's all kinds of technology for amplifying the senses that we have, all the way from hearing aids and cochlear implants to Google Glass. Well, now a few people are taking that a step further by implanting devices in their bodies to give them entirely new sensory experiences. Neil Harbison is an artist. He's grayscale colorblind, which he actually kind of likes. Seeing in shades of black and white turns out to be useful. But Neil wanted to experience color, so he designed a new electronic body part and turned himself into one of the world's first cyborgs. And yes, he says it's okay to call him that.
I feel that I am a cyborg, but I never say, hi, my name is Neil, I'm a cyborg. I don't say that, but I feel that I am a cyborg, yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Well, it's feeling that I am technology. The software and my brain are united, and the cybernetic antenna is a body part, not something that I wear or that I use, but it's something that I am.
Huh. Now, tell me about this. You have an antenna that rises up and kind of curves over your head. It's sort of this beautiful big curve. And as you said, this is not wearable technology. It's actually part of your body. Where and how does it connect?
Well, it's a new body part. It's an antenna, and it looks just like an antenna, like other insects have antennas. It comes out from the skull inside the bone, and then it goes over the head, and then it stops almost between my eyes. So it's a light sensor, a color sensor, that picks up the light frequencies in front of me and then sends these light frequencies to a chip at the back of my head, and then the chip transposes the light frequencies to sound frequencies. Bone conduction allows me to hear the vibrations that I feel at the back of my head. And then each color has a different note. I can sense colors from infrareds, which are invisible to the human eye, to ultraviolets, which are also invisible, and then all the visible ones in between.
Wow. What do the colors sound like? What does blue sound like?
I have like more than 60 blues, but more or less they're around the C and C sharp. They're quite high pitch because the frequency of blue is quite high. If we could hear the light frequencies of color, we would hear red as the lowest between F and F sharp. Then the next one would be orange, which would be a bit higher. And then it goes up yellow, green, turquoise, blue, and violet. And then ultraviolet is the highest.
Wow. And what about you said you can hear colors that are beyond the normal human spectrum, like you can hear infrared?
Yeah, the good thing of perceiving color through an antenna is that you can continue extending color perception beyond human sight. So I sense infrareds, these colors usually used in machines or movement detectors. So if I go into a shop or a bank, I can tell if the alarm is on or off. Also, ultraviolet allows me to know if it's a good day or a bad day to sunbathe.
So I'm thinking just walking along the street, the world must be really noisy to you then.
Yeah, well, noise is usually unwanted sound. And in my case, the first 5 weeks, my brain detected color as noise. Over the months, my brain just got used to it and it stopped being noise. It became a new sense. So it's completely normal for me now to hear notes all the time. I'm always hearing music wherever I look. I like listening to the different cars that go past me or different people or walking around the supermarket where there's lots and lots of different notes. So it's actually really like a concert hall, supermarkets.
So I'm curious about how you navigate the world. I'm thinking that, you've got a fairly big antenna curving up over your head. I suppose you've had to get used to a certain amount of staring.
Yeah, that's the second thing about this project. It's actually like a social experiment, and it's really, every day I have the same type of reactions. It's either people shouting some things at me, like, the aliens are here, something like this, or, Teletubby, or sometimes, I don't know, they shout so many things. I have a list of the different things, or are you going fishing in Italy, they said. I don't know, it varies, but it's always some kind of thing that they shout. And then there's people that just laugh.
I would imagine in the age of terrorism, you'd also run into problems with people thinking that there must be some nefarious thing you're involved with.
Yes, this is also a huge problem. Airport security, also shopping malls, security guards do come in and just start questioning me or kick me out of places But the good thing is that I have a passport with the antenna. So if I carry the passport, I can show them the passport and then they can see that my official image is with an antenna. So they have to accept me as I am on my passport photo.
Wow. You must have to explain this, I mean, thousands of times. By now, you must have a kind of practiced short explanation. What do you say?
Yeah. It's an antenna to hear colors. I say this at least 5 times a day since 2004.
Wow. So you're also a walking diplomat for cyborgs everywhere, I guess.
Well, yeah. I try to also explain what feeling cyborg is. And I think they will have to slowly get used to the fact that there will be more and more people with new body parts and new senses. So I guess it will slowly become more and more normal.
I'm curious, you also developed the Cyborg Foundation. What's its mission?
Well, in 2010, Moon Ribas and I created the Cyborg Foundation, which is an international organization that helps people become cyborgs. So if people want to have a new sense or a new body part, we help them develop their project. And also we defend cyborg rights, so the right to become technology and also the right to have it surgically implanted, because that's also talking with bioethical committees in hospitals and doctors. And then also we promote cyborgism as an art movement. We believe that it's a special interest for artists that want to express themselves through new senses and then create art that has never been possible to create before.
So how many, at a rough guess, how many cyborgs do you think there are in the world now?
It's difficult to tell because I believe that being a cyborg is feeling that you are technology. So you might have a chip inside, but you might not feel any type of connection with the chip. And in my case, for example, I felt that I was a cyborg after 5 months when I started to hear color in my dreams. That's when I felt that the software in my brain had united.
So it's a new sense of self.
Yes, it's a new sense of identity, a really unusual feeling to describe. Also, feeling that you have a new body part is also difficult to describe, but the antenna is like an arm. If someone touches the antenna, I feel it as if someone was touching my arm. If I move it to one side, I feel unbalanced, and it really feels like any other body part.
We have this kind of gut reaction often where we think of a biological human body or an animal body, I guess, and there's a feeling of sort of warmth and affection. And then we think of technology, something, you know, artificially constructed, and that feels to us cold and hard. But you just completely broke down that polarity.
Well, I think it will slowly change because we've always seen technology as something that it doesn't really belong to us. But technology is a human creation, just like human beings. Humans are created by humans, and technology is also created by humans. So the union between humans and human creation, such as technology, makes a lot of sense, and we will slowly, I guess, accept it more and more as a part of us.
So what other kinds of, what other new senses could people use technology to create?
Well, Moon Ribas, for example, she has the seismic sense, so she feels earthquakes whenever there's an earthquake in the planet. So she has this extra skin on her elbow that vibrates whenever there's an earthquake in the world. So she's connected to online seismographs. This gives her a close connection to a natural element. Also, there's another sense, which is feeling what's behind you. It's just a simple infrared that vibrates whenever there's someone behind you. So you have a sensor at the back of your head and you can feel like 360 degrees.
Wow. So in your wildest dreams, I mean, what else do you imagine? And how do you even begin to imagine these things?
Well, I think most of these senses are senses that we can get inspired by nature. If we look at the many animal species, we would all really be amazed about the senses that already exist in this planet. So we really encourage people to get inspired by nature and try to apply senses that already exist in other animal species. Infrared and ultraviolet are senses, colors that many other animal species can perceive. Hearing through bone conduction is something dolphins and other animals in the water can also sense. So I feel actually closer to nature and to other animal species now that I become a cyborg.
I think I'm jealous.
Well, you could also extend your senses and apply technology to your body and then sense whatever you would like to sense in a different way or in a new way. So I really think that we could all explore having a new sense.
That's Neil Harbison. We had a long conversation about the artwork he creates with his new sense and the politics of cyborgism. You can hear it all on our website at ttbook.org. Now, one of the most unexpected places that new work with our senses is cropping up is in therapy. On the chairs and couches of a few psychiatrists and therapists, clients are focused less on telling their stories and more on how their stories feel, how they sound, look, even smell. Psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk runs a groundbreaking trauma center in Massachusetts, and in his new book, The Body Keeps the Score, he writes about how traumatic events disrupt the senses and about how getting back in touch with our bodies can help us heal. Steve Paulson asked him why psychological trauma leaves a physical imprint.
Well, we are our bodies, and in our culture, we forget it. We are animals, and so if we get scared or we're threatened, we secrete stress hormones to get us out of the way to fight back. And if we are trapped, immobilized, can't do anything, those stress hormones keep pounding your body to run and to move and keep you in a state of great agitation. But that agitation then becomes sort of divorced from the original idea, and your body continues to stay in a constant state of threat.
So how does trauma affect our senses, how we respond to the world?
Well, trauma causes our senses to become firstly hyper-acute, very reactive to sounds and lights and touch and various physical stimuli. And then as this goes on, the body sort of desperately tries to calm that down. Many people use drugs, alcohol, to try to do that. Actually, it's probably the single most important cause of drug addiction and alcoholism is a traumatized body that tries to calm itself down. Many people manage to do that without alcohol or drugs, and they just shut off their relationship to their body. One of the effects of trauma, maybe, is that you go through life feeling like a zombie.
Well, you tell a fascinating story in your book of a patient you call Sherry, who was getting a foot massage and apparently had some startled reaction when she realized that the therapist had her hands on her feet.
Yeah, it's really very startling to me also to discover the degree to which traumatized people have a very distorted relationship to their bodies, feel nothing, that whole part of their bodies basically are missing, or they feel too much. They're hyperreactive in their bodies to stuff that nobody can find an origin of.
How could they not? I mean, if someone is massaging your feet, how could you not feel that?
All you need is to shut down your perceptual system in your brain, and you don't feel it. And your brain just learns how to shut down those sensations. All these strange reactions start off as ways in which people try to defend themselves and deal with the horror that's happening to them. But if it continues, then it makes you very ill-equipped to deal with daily life. And this is very much what happens with soldiers, for example, is that your brain gets reorganized to deal with threat. But you become very oblivious to anything else. Nothing means anything to you but the very thing that has caused you pain. And so you get this strange paradox. People get really trapped in that in a terrible way.
Yeah. So what do you do when you see people like this who come in to see you looking for help?
Well, I think most of all, you need to wake yourself up to the present. It's very useful to do things that make people feel alive in the present in their bodies, like singing. We do a lot of yoga. I think martial arts might be helpful. Anything that makes your body feel alive right now, but that's not connected with the trauma per se. So you don't reactivate all the same old circuits again.
Well, you've also done a lot of work with EMDR, eye movement desensitization, and reprocessing. Could you explain how that works?
Well, a very strange technique. About 25 years ago, Francine Shapiro discovered that if you move your eyes back and forth while you think about a very bad event, that event sort of calms itself down, and that eventually became EMDR. And actually, I did some National Institute of Health funded research on that method, being quite skeptical about it initially. And we had fantastic results, actually.
Just moving your eyes back and forth as you're thinking about this traumatic thing that happened?
As you call up the memories, what you saw, what you heard, what you smelled, what you felt in your body, what you were thinking, and you move your eyes from side to side, something starts shifting. And what it looks like happens here is it's very similar to what happens when you dream, when you also move your eyes back and forth. It consolidates memories and attaches us to other things that's happened in your life. When you get traumatized, a number of different brain circuits and brain regions that you need to put an event behind you go offline. When you're so hyper-aroused and terrified in a state of horror, that capacity of the brain to integrate the event, to be able to say, it's over, you know, it was really awful, but now I'm back with my family, I'm back home, and I'm okay. That capacity is interfered with, and it seems like EMDR is one method by which you can bring those brain regions online that you need in order to make a differentiation between things happening now and things having happened a long time ago.
If I were to come into your office, what would you do? How would you do that with me sitting right there?
First of all, I want to get to know you a little bit, so we feel somewhat comfortable with each other. And then I'd say, become very quiet and just say, just sit in your chair and evoke the scene of what happened back then. And I don't ask you to talk about it. One of the great problems with verbal therapy is that the moment you start talking about these terrible things, your body tends to get hijacked and to feel like it's happening all over again. So one of the important things here is to be very quiet and to say, just notice in your mind what happened back then. And then you ask people to go into these eye movements. My hunch is that in hypnosis you can do the same thing, but very few people are doing hypnosis anymore these days. But you go into sort of a trance state, and in the trance state you can sort of rework that memory, and it becomes a memory. Because in the culture, people talk about trauma as an event that happened a long time ago. But in fact, what the trauma is the imprints that that event has left on your mind and in your sensations. The discomfort you feel and the agitation you feel and the rage and the helplessness that is happening right now. And so it's all located in the landscape of your body.
That's remarkable.
It is remarkable.
Yeah. It sounds like you're saying that by doing this, you are kind of draining the emotion out of those memories. I mean, it's not as if you're erasing the memories, but you're sort of turning them into normal memories again.
You're turning them into, and that's what we see and that we can document actually in our research, is that before we do these things, people see it, they hear it, they feel it in their bodies, very overwhelmed by it. And after it's over, they say, yeah, this is what happens back then on March 3rd, 1948 or whenever. And I was a little kid, and now it is September 2014, and I'm a different person now.
Wait, are you saying just after one session of EMDR this can happen?
No. It depends on many different things. The more acute the trauma is, the more efficiently this works. For example, a number of my colleagues saw people who were affected by the Boston Marathon. And within one or two sessions, just it became like, boy, I went through a really bad experience, but I'm safe now. And I see this in my office quite a bit. It's a very gratifying to see people just come to life and say, hey, I'm alive. Thank you very much. They shake your hand and walk out. Okay. But you know,
it's a little hard to believe.
It's hard, a little bit hard to believe, and it's almost too good to be true. But this is what we see in acute trauma quite a bit. If people have been in the war for four different rotations, it isn't so simple. And it takes a much longer period of time to go through it. But the results at the end, if you're patient and you do it, can very much be like that, that people say, I'm back here, I'm back home now.
Have you tried EMDR yourself?
I've tried everything I do. So I do many different methods, EMDR. I'm a great fan, advocate, researcher of yoga. Yoga is a great way of helping people to get in touch with their body, feeling alive in their body, regulate their physiological arousal. And I just published a research study that showed that in our particular population, people were had a better response to yoga than on any pharmacological drug that had ever been studied. And I had done quite a few of the drug studies myself, so I could compare the two.
Are these kinds of practices, are they good for everyone?
Well, you know, if you don't have PTSD, I see no reason to EMDR. But yoga, I think I'm a better person for doing it. I think I'm quieter, more mindful, more tolerant. It's very interesting that the whole culture is, we start off in a Western tradition. The Western tradition is yakking and drugs.
Well, the Western tradition is, has sort of cut the mind off from the body, right?
Right, right. There's also a deep belief that as long as you can talk, things will get better. And talking can be enormously important, but it's very interesting to go to China and India and Japan and to see that they have long traditions doing Qigong, Tai Chi, yoga. And it's very clear to me that those methods were all invented in those cultures to help people with trauma.
It's kind of amusing to hear a psychiatrist talking about the limits of yakking, of talk therapy.
Well, of course, there's much much more extreme people in my profession who believe that you should only give people drugs. No, I think talking is important, but most importantly, befriending yourself, allowing yourself to feel what you feel, and becoming safe in your body is the most important thing in overcoming trauma.
That's psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk. His new book is called The Body Keeps the Score. Bessel and Steve talked a lot more about yoga and trauma, and you can hear that extended conversation on our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, director Albert Nierenberg makes the case that laughter might actually be the best medicine. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Albert Nierenberg. I'm a filmmaker, boredom, stupidity, laughology, and I actually work as a laughologist. I'm often hired by companies or stressed out institutions to try to make large groups of people laugh. Laughter, we know, pretty well everybody knows the old folks saying laughter is the best medicine is very well known. There's now relatively new science that says that laughter is a hedge against heart disease. It strengthens the immune system, and it may be a natural antidepressant. So, of course, we should all laugh as much as possible. But here's the thing, there's actually a catch. It's not easy just to provoke laughter at any time. Most people think that they can't laugh on the spot or force laughter. And I want to suggest to you that there is a hack for laughter that can allow groups of people, usually doesn't work on your own because laughter is a social behavior, that allows groups of people to be able to spontaneously laugh at any time. The hack is very simple. It's based on the idea that human beings are wired to laugh in similar ways. So for example, almost anywhere you go in the world, you find that people will laugh with what's called a ha-ha-ha sound. So it goes a bit like this, like ha-ha-ha-ha. That ha-ha-ha sound turns out to be contagious if done in the following way. Basically, the hack for laughter is the sound ha-ha-ha plus people while making eye contact in close proximity. So what you want to do is get a bunch of people who have to be well-disposed. If their attitude is like, yeah, make me laugh, it may not work. But if they're well-disposed, meaning they're going to give it a try, you put them in a tight circle. You make sure they're making eye contact. Together, you breathe in through the nose. And as you breathe out, you simply go, ha, 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 together. I will virtually guarantee that in almost every case, you will genuinely provoke real laughter. And that is the hack for laughter. And using all these things like laughter yoga or laughter sighs, all are based on that principle. Laughter has been hacked and you can laugh a lot more. If you're interested, it's on YouTube. I demonstrate the hack for laughter. I think if you search hack for laughter on YouTube, you'll find it there with a visual demonstration. There's even other things you can do that make it even better, which is that if people are smiling before they do it, even more. If they're already in a kind of a heavier breathing state, even more. I would say if they're already laughing, it's going to be 99%. Laughter may really be the best medicine. The only catch is you need to do a lot of laughing to get the benefit.
Filmmaker Albert Nierenberg. We'll post a link to the video on our website. On our minds this week, Ebola. With the international community sending money, doctors, and resources to help stop the virus that's spreading across West Africa, we turn to medical historian Greg Mittman. He says to really understand how and why people there and here are responding to the outbreak, you have to know the history of Western medicine in Africa. He told Sarah Nix that he was working in Liberia when the virus was first reported in the capital, Monrovia.
I remember getting up in the morning and looking at one of the daily newspapers and seeing on the headline, Ebola in town. It was definitely a cause for concern. And particularly given what I knew about the public health infrastructure in Liberia. Liberia went through a 14-year brutal civil war that ended in 2003. There has been a decade of peace and stability and economic development. But the level of medical infrastructure there has been slow to build up.
Right. And I read that there are only 200-some doctors for a population of 4 million.
That's right. You know, you'll get widely fluctuating figures about how many doctors there are. Some figures you'll see as low as 50 to upwards of 200. But yes, we can roughly say 200 doctors for a population of approximately 4 million people.
Hmm. And people in the community, Liberians, how were people talking about the Ebola outbreak there?
You know, it went through really a lot of different stages. When I was there in late June, early July, it was kind of in the background. People were aware of it. Two nurses had died at a Redemption Hospital that were treating an Ebola-infected patient. So there was certainly cause for concern. But at the time, it was kind of in the background when I was there. That began to change over the month of July.
How so?
One of the things was a sense among certain parts of the population of disbelief that Ebola wasn't real.
That the reports had been faked somehow? Or?
Maybe faked, where there's, you know, a kind of level of mistrust of government going back to the Civil War. And there were reports that, you know, maybe this was a scam for the government to get more outside money. So there were certain elements of disbelief. I wouldn't say it was widespread, but certainly, you know, there were rumors like that. One of the things that the Western media quickly seized upon when it became an international story was the attack on healthcare workers by West Africans. And
attack on healthcare workers on what grounds?
Well, you know, so the Western media was attributing this to irrationality and superstition. And I think there's a complicated set of circumstances that led to those initial reactions that speaks to a history of Western biomedical research in West Africa. Since really the 1920s, Liberia has in some ways become a kind of laboratory for American biomedical research. One of the reasons we were there was we were retracing the itinerary of a Harvard medical expedition through Liberia in 1926. It was there sponsored by Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, which was building the largest rubber plantation at that time. And one of the biggest obstacles was disease.
Right. And you wrote this paper about it that I just looked through. And it seems like Firestone wanted to be in the country. They wanted to grow rubber. But they saw the people living there also as part of the natural resources.
Absolutely. And so they, in some ways, became medical subjects. So as this Harvard team of doctors and scientists moved through the landscape, they took biological samples, tumors and blood and parasites. They also tested experimental drugs on them. They were testing an experimental compound for the treatment of sleeping sickness. And that kind of history continued on. In the 1940s and 50s, Liberia was one of the first places where experiments were done using DDT for malaria eradication. So widespread, massive sprayings of DDT through the area to try and control malaria. In the 1970s, there was a lot of work going on there on hepatitis A and B vaccine research. So part of the suspicion of healthcare workers initially certainly was connected to that long history of biomedical research and extraction that goes back in Liberia's past.
And my understanding is that the project you were there working on was retracing the steps of this 1920s Firestone expedition and talking with people about whether they had heard stories about the expedition. Is that right?
Yeah, we were really retracing the itinerary of the expedition to find out what kind of history and memory existed about it. And more particularly, one of the things that happened was the expedition was filmed, and we had that film record. And it turns out that that motion picture record is the earliest motion picture record of Liberia's past to survive the Civil War. And so we were trying there really to gather these stories about history and memory.
And not particularly about the medical stuff,
not
just
about
in
the medical stuff, right. Mm-hmm. But really to try and ask what role the past could play in the reconciliation in Liberia today and in the wakes of the Civil War.
And in terms of the medical question, are there ways that you see that expedition and all of the experiments and tests that were carried out there having some kind of repercussions in today's situation in Liberia?
Yeah, I do. Because really the Firestone operation was really a kind of early experiment in a kind of neoliberal approach to public health, that is in a kind of relying not upon government, but on private capital to bring development to a country. That didn't really come to pass. So by the 1940s, the U.S. State Department became quite concerned that Firestone's presence in Liberia was really not doing much to improve the health and well-being of the Liberian people. It was getting a lot of profit out of the Liberian landscape, and Liberia became the major supplier of rubber to the U.S. during the Second World War when it was cut off from Malaysian markets. But that wasn't really trickling down.
It wasn't benefiting the people on the ground.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and there really wasn't a huge investment by Firestone in building medical capacity among Liberians and public health knowledge among Liberians. And so as a result, in the 1940s, the U.S. sent an economic mission to Liberia. It was a 9-member team of African-American engineers, doctors, public health experts to go and really begin to try and help build Liberia's public health infrastructure and engineering infrastructure. That was quite successful. But note that it was dependent on government and the state, not upon private industry.
Right.
So during the 50s and 60s, it was boom times in Liberia. I mean, it was the economic hub of West Africa. All of that was erased during the Civil War. And a lot of knowledge and people with education and the means that could flee Liberia did. And so over the last 10 years, there's been a real effort to bring that knowledge back to build up the capacity. But what we're seeing is, in terms of development, another wave of multinational corporations, large land concessions to agriculture and mining industry. So it's kind of like Firestone again, without, again, the kind of investment in the basic needs of a population in terms of education and public health that are really important to the long-term peace and stability of a region.
Huh. And I wonder how the Ebola outbreak either helps or hinders the development of civil services. I mean, do you think it helps that international attention is there and maybe there'll be more medical infrastructure going in? Or does it hurt because suddenly the West sees, again, gets reinforced these stereotypes of Africa's dangerous, it's full of disease, and things are out of control?
Yeah, no, there's certainly that element of it. And, you know, that has a long history going back to the 18th century and thinking about equatorial Africa and West Africa as the white man's grave and that this is a place where disease lurks. The other things that we see in the disaster response is a kind of movement in, address the crisis, and then pull out, right? And then what's left? It's going to be people that are there for the long haul, right, that are really going to be committed to finally address the public health infrastructure in places like Liberia and begin to see that you cannot have development without public health. That's the kind of attention that's going to be needed. And whether the Liberian government, working in cooperation with concessions that it has given all these multinational corporations, can begin to address that is a question.
Greg Mittman teaches the history of science and medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Sarah Nix talked with him. And that's it for this hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today's show was produced by Sarah Nix with help from Raymond Tungekar, Joe Hartke, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.